Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. With me in the studio once again, Jameer Jamok of the United Way's Hometown Hires and Todd McFadden of the Upperman African American Cultural Center at UNCW. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Right before we went to break, we were talking about the reinvigoration of the civil rights movement that really got launched onto the national stage in Ferguson, Missouri. And that's when a lot of us for the first time started seeing signs that said Black Lives Matter. And Essence magazine in its February issue, its Black History Month issue, for the first time in its history had no graphic on the cover and just had those words, Black Lives Matter. For some of us, that idea is almost incomprehensible, the notion that those words even need to be said. Can you explain what that really means?
Well, I mean,
Jameer Jamok,
kind of adding on to what I was saying before the break, I mean, for us in the Black community, and I'm speaking from my own opinion, but my understanding and from my perception, you know, we have become desensitized to the idea of us being treated unequal. So therefore, like I said, when the delegations was going about, we kind of already knew what was going to happen before it happened, because we've seen it happen so many times before, whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's Eric Garner, or whatever the case is, or whether it's the gentleman, or Oscar Grant, and the gentleman in Charlotte, the young boy that played football. You know, so we see it so many times. We see Rodney King. We see all of these different instances where, you know, our freedoms aren't protected or we're abused or whatever the case is, and then the people that are responsible never get held accountable. So for us, it's kind of relays back to the times of, you know, of the Jim Crow South, when there was repetitive lynchings in the streets, and you know, it was kind of justified, and it's kind of a parallel to what it is now. So when you say Black Lives Matter, we're saying that we should have the same equal rights as a human, as everybody else.
And the important thing to me was this was not just an American movement. This was international. There were huge protests that weren't covered as much in London, in Asia, in India, in Africa. There were a lot of people outraged. And in many countries, in many instances, there were protests where there were, weren't very many Black people at all, if any, in the crowd. So this got a lot of folks' attention.
So much of this discussion focuses on the psychological impact that our cultural expectations have to do with the social implications of those expectations. And Jameer Jamok, you have a really compelling personal story, because you grew up in a household without a father. And you talk about, at one point in your public school career, you had a teacher that had a lot of what you call cultural competency. Mm-hmm. And what did that mean to you? And how did that teacher help to change your life?
Well, knowing what I know now, there's this sociological theory called the self-fulfilling prophecy. And during that time in school, you know, around third grade, I'll give you a great example. In the second grade, I had an African-American teacher, Ms. Brooks, who used to talk to us all the time about Black history and different things of that nature. And she kind of understood where I came from, the circumstances that I was in, and things of that nature. And then you fast forward to third grade, I was placed in a BEH class, which is Behaviorally Emotionally Handicapped class. And in that class, I was exposed to a teacher who was from some kind of like a rural area where there wasn't a lot of diversity. She didn't understand my culture. She had very negative pre-notions about where I was from, my neighborhood, and things of that nature. And she always used to like feed me with real negative stereotypes. And during that time, I started to live up to those stereotypes.
And you actually changed things for yourself. You went down the road. You went to prison at some point, mm-hmm. a couple of times. But your journey to something else, to a path of prosperity and success in this life, was very much internally driven. You take a lot of personal responsibility for where you are. You talk about the time when you realized that your behavior has a direct impact on the quality of your life.
Yeah.
And you've said that it's not the KKK that's on the street corner shooting us, we're shooting each other.
Definitely.
So how do you find the balance between that idea of personal responsibility and the notion that some stuff has to change in our cultural conversation?
Well, I mean, for me, I had my real divine intervention, or if that's what you want to call it, or a moment of clarity while I was in jail. And it was offered to me by a counselor, and he presented us. It was a room full of us. And he presented this equation for life that he called intellect over emotion times action equals success. I mean, it was something very profound about that. And when I went back to my bunk, I started to recant all of the things in my mind that and all the trouble that I had got into. And a lot of it was based in emotion. A lot of it, you know, there's all these different kind of emotional components to a person, whether it be anger, whether it be insecurity, whether it be, you know, whatever the case is. And I started to really look at myself and say, I had to be accountable for me. You know, I've always been an advocate for the underdog and the socially oppressed. And I've always, you know, had this pinned up anger and frustration. Because, like I said, I wasn't taught about the goodness in myself, and I was always taught that we were fighting and striving for equality. But when we looked around, I didn't never see that equality presenting itself in my everyday reality.
And so acting out and you know, rebelling or protesting or whatever you want to call it, and taking things for yourself is an understandable reaction to some of the roadblocks that were just thrown in your way. But you still were able to kind of alter your path and get it onto the right road. What would you say? I mean, there are so many kids who aren't able, for whatever reason, to do what you did. What would you say to those kids now?
I mean, basically, nobody gets nowhere on their own. And the first time you tell yourself that, then you're telling yourself a lie. You know, I've been fortunate to be exposed to a lot of wisdom from a lot of people. And the good thing about, you know, I have a book coming out called Follow the Leader. It's called Follow the Leader. And the thing about it is I go all the way back in the academic sense of leadership, but then also in the real world sense of leadership. And I talk about all the mentors that I was influenced by throughout my transitional process. And the great thing that I found while writing the book was that I didn't just learn from my mentors about the good attributes and characteristics to take away from those people. I also learned from their mistakes. And for me, that's something as youth that I did as a child and that children do now. We have a tendency to say that, you know, when I jumped off my stoop, I didn't have a lot of role models per se. I didn't, you know, the people that made it successfully out of my neighborhood, some of them didn't come back for whatever reason.
And so then that person gets out of that situation, but there's no positive role model for the kids who are still there.
Yeah, but the thing about it is there's always a lesson to be learned. So you can take away from the mistakes that people are making around you and apply that to yourself. Like, everybody thinks that being a drug dealer is a profitable business, when the truth of the matter is that a lot of people are not successful in being drug dealers. So you would think if somebody has set the mold in front of you and you've seen them go to prison, you've seen them get killed, that you would be able to take that experience and take that wisdom and apply it to yourself to go in a different direction. But what happens is we always feel like, no, we're the one that's going to do it differently.
Right.
We're going to make it happen. So I would just encourage children and youth and people in general to just be conscious of what they're doing in the moment and to be conscious of the people around you. You can get wisdom and knowledge from all sorts of people from different type of backgrounds, because for me, for my evolutional process, it's been people in the Black community, white community, and so forth that have helped me transition to this point.
And Jameer Jamoke, wrote a book, Todd McFadden. So this will be part of history that is no longer just an oral tradition.
Absolutely. And I really love what Jameer has to say about this. You know, one of the things that I learned, even in coming to Wilmington, I love this community. And specifically, I also love the Black community here. I participate in as many things as I can and really try to give back. I've even been working on going into the prisons and kind of relating those messages, because I think there's a great necessity for folks to hear from folks. I didn't grow up in great circumstances. I was in inner city Baltimore, but it was a circumstance for me where I had two parents in the home. I went to a little more elite college and was able to, I think, learn a lot about myself there, because it was a school that was one of the first to admit African Americans even before slavery had ended, well before slavery had ended. And so I was able to take those lessons and learn a little bit more about myself. And, you know, particularly as we grow older, we definitely understand the value of reaching back and bringing others forward with you.
Definitely.
It's the only thing that counts.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Black History Month and how our treatment of it has an impact on our cultural and racial conversation today. Just a few minutes left in the show. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, the number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. The Wilmington 10, Todd McFadden, can you tell us briefly what that's about? That's a part of this city's, the city of Wilmington's history.
Yeah.
And it was in the 1970s, and it right. became an international story.
Well, of course, I think most of us here know the story of these nine African-American men and one white woman who were protesting the closing of Williston High School and were essentially, turns out, they were framed. The Wilmington Journal actually broke the story a couple of years ago about the notes of the prosecutor and it being happy that there were KKK members on the jury and that sort of thing, that kind of, I think, helped to, that led to their pardon of that group. It's a great story. When I first got to UNCW, I think I didn't know much about it. I heard about it, and we were actually in the midst of planning a 40-year anniversary about the Wilmington 10, and I kind of, you know, in my way, looked bookishly at it. I went and I called up Amnesty International in London and said, can I get some information and that sort of thing. And when I brought that back to some of the 10 who were there, they kind of looked at me sideways because for them it was a very real thing. It wasn't a historical event.
Right.
And that's, I think, a lesson I've had to learn a lot about from Wilmington.
Why did it take so long for there to be a pardon of innocence? Because I think it was well established
right.
that there was mishandling of the entire
yeah.
case. And yet it took until 2013, when Bev Perdue was leaving office,
right.
to actually issue that pardon. Why?
Well, I can speculate.
Yeah.
And that's that, again, and this is, I think, something that's pretty common for judicial systems. They don't like necessarily to admit wrongdoing in something like that. So it's a big step for them to say, we're going to pardon these guys that we treated them wrongly. It's a big step.
Just a couple minutes left. Ulysses, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. And that's not Ulysses. Ulysses, are you there? Hi,
yes,
welcome
sir.
To Coastline. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I'm so glad to be there. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yep.
Okay. I feel that, and I've been listening to you for 2 weeks now, one of the biggest things that happened in 1898 and still happening today is the suppression of the Black voice.
Mm-hmm.
I thank God for the Journal.
Yeah.
And in the American history, we have had a few other media outlets like the Pittsburgh Courier, the Michigan Chronicle, other newspapers. But over the recent history, the last 50 years, if you can just keep the voice of history, actual history, the truth, from getting to the masses, then you control what they do get. For example, one of the reasons Black colleges are being shut down is because they used to teach about what happened in in Wilmington. But that's only the Black colleges.
Todd McFadden, I see you nodding,
well,
agreeing with you, Ulysses.
You know, it's really for me about competing narratives that take place. I think one of the things that moved the civil rights movement forward was the advent of the media. Now they were able to broadcast what was happening, and so it really was an embarrassment to the United States, who was preaching kind of their superiority in terms of politics, in terms of you know, a social life that was against communism and all these things that suppressed people. And it was hard to then put forward that narrative when you could look on TV and see terrible things being done to citizens. So I think the new media has turned out to be social media. And people, everybody has a phone now that takes pictures and those sorts of things. And I think it's making a difference.
And to add on to what he said, I definitely agree with that, because even in terms of the Woman's Intent, if you see the public perception of someone like Ben Chavis, who, when Ben Chavis came to this community, he placed a great emphasis on teaching these students Black history in the back of the church, which was something that they felt like they wasn't getting once they were integrated into the mainstream school system outside of Williston. And it seems like a lot of times, like you said, when you have somebody raising the level of consciousness and bringing that historical facts back into context, that if they're not, they're often seen as a troublemaker, and then they're suppressed.
Ulysses, thanks so much for your call. Final thoughts, just a few seconds left. Todd McFadden.
Well, my final thoughts are that certainly we need to celebrate the African-Americans' contribution to American history and the world history more than 1 month a year. I think this is a good month to concentrate on it, but certainly it needs to be a part of what we learn every day.
Jameer Jamoak.
I believe we need to broaden the scope of African-American history in the school system. And in addition to that, you know, the Black Lives Matters should be an everyday thing. You know, don't just wait until there's a tragic incident to jump on the front and start going to war. We need to be taking that same kind of energy back into our communities every day, so we can practice an intervention versus, a prevention versus an intervention model.
Thank you both so much for joining us on this edition of Coastline. Join us next week. That's next Wednesday at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.